The gruesome spectacle of the Amber Heard Johnny Depp trial that made the nightly news made a much bigger splash on social media. But was something else at play? Was Amber Heard the victim of an orchestrated campaign of misinformation? On social media, on Twitter, there were absolutely reams and reams of extreme misogyny and hate directed at Heard. Some from accounts that seemed less than human, which seemed designed to deliberately rubbish Amber's reputation online.
The queen of domestic violence claiming that she's a victim of violence is the biggest joke.
What other options
ever
does a violent, predatory narcissist have when they are desperate to control their victim?
Your voice is gone, Amber Heard.
I'm coming for you when you get out of court.
Who wants to join me in my expedition to brutally murder Amber Heard?
Well, Alexei Mostros of Tortoise Media is a London-based journalist who's previously tackled catfishing and disinformation in his previous very popular podcasts, Sweet Bobby and Hoaxed. And with the help of a team of data analysts, he dug through hundreds of thousands of tweets to uncover a shocking revelation in his latest series. It's called Who Trolled Amber? Now, a warning, there are spoilers in our conversation, although I think you could still listen to the podcast and it not be spoiled by any chance. I asked Alexei what he noticed about what was billed as the trial of the century at the very start.
So I guess if I'm being really honest, I didn't notice much about it at the time, apart from that, like, I was kind of subconsciously aware that it was everywhere. But it didn't really interest me because I was on another project and so concentrating on that. But B, I thought, these are two famous people, probably both of them are quite damaged. I don't really care what happens in their private life. And the whole thing seemed the sort of story that I wasn't really interested in. And then a contact of mine who I really respected and I've worked with before in the misinformation space, who kind of, it's his job to like identify online misinformation campaigns. We were speaking about this and he said, you should take a look at this case because what I'm seeing online in terms of what's coming out of this case, it reminds me of the sort of state-run disinformation campaigns that I've been looking at. And at that point, I was kind of interested.
Yeah, I suppose your radar begins to ping at that point. And the hate campaign was huge. It was, as you say, if you were at all connected on social media, it was very hard to avoid. It was on the mainstream news, certainly over here.
Sure.
When you looked into that campaign, what did you begin to see?
So it's easy to look at that campaign and to immediately recognise that there was a huge amount of hatred being directed towards Amber Heard, even though she was the one that was alleging abuse. And a relatively small amount of hatred going kind of back the other way. It seemed like a kind of one-way street in terms of what was happening online. But that was sort of expected because Johnny Depp has this huge fan base. He's much more well-known than Amber Heard. And his fans are kind of like really, really rabidly loyal to him. So the fact that there was this massive imbalance didn't in itself like prove anything, but the more you looked, the more patterns began to emerge, which suggested that at least a proportion of that online hate directed towards Amber Heard wasn't organic. It wasn't created by real accounts. It was created by either automated accounts called bots or paid for accounts, which are sort of more sophisticated versions of inauthentic accounts. They're human beings that are basically paid to promote a point of view.
So you started taking a look and you were able to get an enormous cache of social media posts. Was that what really began to crack this open for you?
Yeah, I mean, part of the problem of analysing any of this stuff is that, like, it's such a kind of moving feast. Like, accounts that are there in 2020 and 2021, a lot of them won't be there now. And also, like, I don't want to get too much into the weeds of it, but, like, Elon Musk has, since taking over Twitter, he's, like, really shut down the ability of researchers and journalists to look at information and to reach kind of broad conclusions about what's happening on the platform. So we discovered that this guy who had testified in the Amber Heard case in the US, a computer expert called Ron Schnell, had created this database of like more than 1 million tweets that had been sent critical of Amber Heard in the years leading up to the trial. But he hadn't been allowed to talk really about what was on that database at the trial, but he was willing to give it to us. So that was sort of the first step on our quest to find out what happened. We went over to Miami and we got that database, and then we took that database to two like really kind of world leading misinformation researchers and said, okay, go away, spend like a month, 6 weeks looking at this and come back and tell us what you found.
And what did they find?
They found widespread evidence of inauthentic activity. One of the researchers, a guy called Johan Chen, thought that in his kind of expert opinion, more than 50% of the whole database, in other words, like more than half of the tweets that were sent about Amber that were critical of her in the run-up to the trial were inauthentic, in other words, created by bots or paid for trolls. And within that kind of broad headline result, both of the experts identified like specific instances of like bot farms that were operating in Thailand and in Chile and in Spain or Spanish-speaking countries. That exhibited clear patterns of behavior suggestive of an organized, coordinated campaign to attack her.
So is this the point that you began to think, oh, yeah, there's maybe a story here. There's maybe something I can do with this.
Do you know, I mean, it's one of the kind of like perils of podcasting that like we'd already put in like maybe 3 months work to get to this point, 4 months. And so, like, if there hadn't have been a story, like, that would have been really... It was more of a kind of, like, relief, as in, like, oh, shit, we haven't been wasting our time.
Yeah, yeah. Because, as you say, it does take a huge amount of work and effort and travel expense and all these other things. You don't quite know what you're going to get at the end of it. But at what point did you really kind of get a surprise? At what point did this story begin to confound your expectations?
I think it was when we switched focus to looking at like who could have been responsible, because I always suspected that there would be like a kind of big element of bot activity around this case, and so finding these networks was kind of it supported what I already kind of considered to be probable. But what I didn't really think that we'd get was any indication of who was running any of this, because it's ridiculously hard to kind of pinpoint perpetrators of bot campaigns, because accounts can just be created like at a click of a button, totally anonymously, you know, in their hundreds and with no fingerprints at all. So the thing that really surprised me was when we came across like a group of Twitter accounts, some of which are still active today. If you go on them, they'll have pictures of Johnny Depp all over them. They'll have like all of their tweets will be about Johnny Depp and how cool he is and how horrible Amber was, and they'll all be in English. And if you put those Twitter details into the Wayback Machine, which is this sort of internet tool that allows you to kind of see old versions of web pages, you can see that these accounts were not posting anything in English 2 years ago. All their tweets were in Arabic, and they weren't posting anything about any celebrities or Johnny Depp or Amber Heard. They were posting about how great Saudi Arabia was and how amazing Saudi Arabia's ruler is, a guy called Mohammed bin Salman. So when we discovered these accounts, we were like, what's going on? Why would an account have been tweeting about like Saudi's green energy policy 2 years ago in Arabic, and then like fast forward to today and they're tweeting about Johnny Depp in English, nothing about Saudi Arabia or energy at all? And so we took that evidence to misinformation experts who worked in the Middle East, and they said that the tweets and the patterns of tweets reminded them of Saudi Arabian government controlled bots. Now Saudi Arabia is like this huge state-run bot operation, these troll farms that operate on behalf of the government, that basically are there to kind of promote government messaging or to kind of like disparage enemies of the state. So anytime there's like a government issue, they'll like pour onto Twitter and other social networks, these bots, and they'll pump out like pro-Saudi messages. So these experts were telling us that the Johnny Depp accounts seem to be part of this like Saudi troll army. And then the next question is, well, why would Saudi Arabia want to prop up a kind of, half has been Hollywood actor? And the answer is that, or potentially the answer is that, like, Johnny Depp and Saudi Arabia have an incredibly close relationship. Like, Saudi Arabia has helped finance his last two movies. He's been to the country like a number of times in the last 2 years as the guest of the state. He's been pictured in like tourist resorts. He said lovely things about the Saudi Arabian film community. And most weirdly, he seems to be like actually kind of close personal friends with Mohammed bin Salman, the controversial crown prince of Saudi Arabia. So you take it all together and you can see that Saudi had method, motive, and opportunity to play part of a role, but to put at least some of its resources into supporting Johnny Depp online and disparaging Amber Heard. And like that, I don't want to pretend that that kind of explains the whole of the trolling against her, but it was an element, and it was an interesting element because we never expected the story to jump from Hollywood to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, that was the mic drop moment for me when I was listening, where you suddenly go, Saudi? Like, what's. I don't get it. But the interesting thing about Saudi Arabia is that a big chunk of the population are on Twitter. And I guess this is why it's able to be used partly as a sort of a soft power means of control of the population.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I'm not a Saudi expert, but we spoke to enough people who are that they told us exactly that, that Saudi has this huge Saudi Arabia, the citizens, they love Twitter. There's a big kind of use of Twitter within the country, and the Saudi state has form in controlling the messaging on Twitter and in terms of using bots to kind of get their messaging out. Like, if you look up, Saudi Arabia Twitter scandals on Google, you'll see that like over the last like few years there have been like instances where Saudi have tried to kind of like pay Twitter employees to like leak them sensitive information, where they've used bots to kind of put out messages that are helpful to their cause. That there's like an established pattern of behavior in terms of Saudi and Twitter, which this Depp stuff seems to fit into.
You're listening to Saturday Morning with Susie Ferguson here on RNZ National, and my guest is Alexei Mostras. You might know him from Sweet Bobby or Hoaxed, some of the previous podcasts he's made for Tortoise Media. We're talking specifically, though, about his latest podcast, Who Trolled Amber? The links that you were talking about, how far do they go back? Because, as you mentioned, Saudi Arabia has the means and the motive to do this. But when did all of this get started?
Yeah, so it's a really good question because the chronology is one of the main reasons why we think that Saudi probably wasn't responsible for the majority of the trolling. You can see that all these Johnny Depp accounts that used to be pro-Saudi accounts, they started towards the end of the trial in the US and then kind of ramped up after the trial, which kind of makes complete sense because that's when the Saudis started financing Depp's movies and Depp started going over to the country. It still leaves this big question about like if there was inauthentic activity, significant inauthentic activity before that point, then who commissioned it and why? And we haven't got a firm answer. We've got suspicions, and we've kind of got a wide list of suspects, but it's really, really tricky without like seeing an internal contract. Then you can kind of only speculate. What it did do is it made us look at like quite closely at Johnny Depp's team, and particularly his lawyer, a guy called Adam Waldman. And while we could not show that Adam Waldman had anything to do with any commissioning of any bots, and he's denied that any bots have been used, we did raise quite serious questions, I think, about Adam Waldman's behavior in terms of interacting with real life trolls online and feeding them information that would be useful to Johnny Depp and damaging to Amber Heard.
So I guess all of this ultimately comes back to a celebrity trial. This is the scene set that this happens in. And so, as you say, when you were sort of aware of this going on as the trial was progressing, it wasn't something that you necessarily were taking that much notice of. So I suppose, why does this matter? And is it because of the way that the bots and the trolls were able to be marshaled?
Yeah, I think it matters because although bots and trolls were used in a celebrity case this time, there is really no assessment of how widespread this industry is because it operates under the radar. And what we did learn was that A, it is very, very easy for firms based in Israel, based in London, based in wherever you want to create fake internet profiles with backgrounds and pictures and convincing backstories with the click of a button. And these profiles can be used for any purposes. They can be used by a celebrity or his PR team. They can be used by an oligarch who's fighting another oligarch and wants an edge before a big trial. They can be used by a politician or a political party before an election. And, especially this year when, dozens of countries are ho holding elections and when democracy is really kind of on trial, for me, the story makes me question why I believe what I believe. Because so much of what we believe now, I think, is based on what we read online. And what we read online is kind of packaged up in very small little bite-sized chunks that it's very difficult to kind of stop and analyze the source of and to get to grips with whether it's reliable or not. So it's very easy for someone who wants to manipulate the game to insert fake news, fake information, fake profiles into the discourse in order to manipulate it for their own purposes. So for me, the story makes me think to myself, do I really trust what I believe? And how do I kind of double check that and make sure that someone isn't trying to manipulate me for their own purposes?
Because I guess in some ways, this gives a sense of the proof of concept. It shows that it worked to some extent, that something was going on to smudge the edges of reality, and it worked. Because the jury in this case wasn't sequestered. So does that mean they were likely influenced?
Yeah, exactly. So I think you're completely right. I think that what our evidence showed was that significant inauthentic activity took place online to the detriment of Amber Heard in the run-up to the trial. So by the time the jury took their seats, the kind of the weight of evidence online was already predisposed against her. And as you said, during the trial, they weren't sequestered, which means that they could have gone home. They did go home every night. And they could have accessed the internet during the course of the trial, and that online situation could have affected how they were thinking about the case. Now, there are a lot of could haves in that scenario. It's more a case of risk that you reach a situation where they. What was online might have affected their decision because they weren't sequestered. And that is kind of scary enough for the administration of justice to kind of be worrying in itself.
And you mentioned this is the year of elections, if you like, perhaps most notably in the United States towards the end of the year. So how do we look at this in terms of what ramifications there are or there could be on democracy?
I think that there are pretty serious ramifications for democracy. And this is what always kind of really interested me in the story, because like it does go much further beyond Amber Heard and Johnny Depp. Like, basically, I don't think we fully understand how easy it is to manipulate public sentiment online, because I think most people, they read what they read online and they might check, you know, 1 out of 10 things or 1 out of 20 things. But if they keep seeing something, then I think it's a natural human emotion to say that there must be that it must be at least partly true. And you can today, for a very little amount of money, buy 100, 1,000, 10,000 accounts online that will pour out, pump out the same message that you want over and over again. And some of those accounts will get caught, and some of them will get put into spam, but a lot of them will get through. And so there's a great opportunity, I think, today to manipulate public sentiment for your own purposes. And that is in itself kind of a structural threat to democracy that I'm not sure that we're properly grappling with.
And of course, it also comes with the kind of bursting out of AI, of ChatGPT. How is that also going to affect this? These two things are going to merge. The deepfake technology we already know is there. It feels like this is a problem that has the capacity to accelerate by orders of magnitude in very little time.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't have put it like better, I don't think. I mean, we interviewed someone who'd exposed a disinformation firm working out of Israel, who already had the technology to create dozens of social media profiles with backstories, with pictures, with kind of everything that you need to kind of mount a misinformation campaign. And that was in like 2021, 2022. In 2026, 2027, you will be able to create profiles that are pretty much indistinguishable from human profiles, thanks to, as you said, a combination of generative AI technology and deep fake technology. You just will not be able to tell if someone's a human or not. And what is our answer to that as a society? I don't think we have one yet.
I was going to say, what is our answer to that? How do we sort of guard against that or attempt to push back against that?
I don't think we have an answer. I think we need to get a handle on it. And I think that at the moment, what's really worrying is that like the stuff that is getting the most media attention is the kind of the big glossy kind of deep fake videos, like Obama or Trump saying something incorrect. And you know, that's obviously like really important. But actually, the really kind of invidious bits of information come from accounts that take a little bit of truth and then manipulate it or put it out of context or amplify it. So if you see like 100, 200, 1,000 accounts that all seem real, all putting out the same message, or thanks to ChatGPT, kind of different varieties of the same message in very human language, that to my mind is a much bigger threat than a couple of videos that are created by kind of fake technology. Technologies like ChatGPT and deepfake technologies, when combined, will allow someone to manipulate the internet and social media in ways that we perhaps can't even envisage.
This isn't the first time that you've made a podcast series around perhaps this sort of area. People may know Sweet Bobby, which is about catfishing, or Hoaxed, which is essentially about disinformation centered around Hampstead in North London, amongst others that you've done. What is it about this particular area that fascinates you so much?
I think what I'm fascinated by is like how much of our lives we all live online today. Like we really do split our consciousness between the real world and the online world. And yet our institutions, our police, our schools, our courts, they're all set up to deal with behaviors that manifest themselves in the real world. They're not really set up yet to deal with behaviors on the online world, whether that's a conspiracy theory or a disinformation campaign or, you know, a catfishing operation. There's a gap between the regulatory systems that govern our physical world and those that govern our digital world. And a lot of people are falling into that gap. And I'm quite interested in looking at that more closely.
So I guess the fact that there's a gap, does that mean that regulation could be part of the answer?
I think it's regulation. Yeah, I think that there's regulation is part of the answer, but I think it's also like across the board. It's like our judges need to understand better that coercive control or stalking can happen online as well as offline. Our schools need to understand that, like, you know, information that parents give them, private information, might be taken and put online and so placing the children at risk. It's across the board understanding that now the online world is kind of almost as important as the offline world, and that's not there yet.
As a journalist who has now done several series in this territory, you've become a target of trolling as well. What has that meant for your life?
So yeah, thanks for mentioning it. I knew I was going to get trolled by like Johnny Depp supporters, bots. You know, I knew I was going to be targeted after Who Trolled Amber, and I genuinely thought that it wouldn't really affect me. Like, what do I care what some person on the other side of the Atlantic is saying about me? But after about 2 weeks after the podcast came out, and I was receiving these like hundreds of like really kind of personal attacks, my wife was like, why are you so depressed? Why are you so down? And I think it was because it was just the sheer weight of the attacks that were kind of cumulatively like affecting me. And compared to like what most public figures get on a daily basis, especially female public figures, like I didn't get, you know, a tenth of that. And yet it was kind of getting through to my consciousness. So I just used, after that, I was just like block, 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 and just used the block button like 500 times. And then, and now it's fine.
Yeah. Do you still use social media?
Yeah, sure.
Is that partly though for your job?
Yes. Yes. I don't think I'd use it if it wasn't.
Because big tech's response to all of this, I mean, you mentioned at the beginning, near the beginning of this conversation, that Elon Musk has very much kind of shut down the ability to use Twitter in some ways for things like journalism since he took over Twitter. It's now called X. Is big tech going to further, do you think, curtail that?
I think there's always been a problem between what society needs big tech to be and what big tech will be because it wants to make a profit. I think the profit motive of big technology companies is just like fundamentally inconsistent with behaving responsibly. Their kind of ultimate goal is to keep us on these platforms as long as possible. And to do that, they serve us what we want to see, and they will serve us stuff that they know will keep us on the platform as long as possible, and that's not necessarily the stuff that is the healthiest for us. So I have a kind of quite pessimistic view of the steps that I think big tech companies are willing to take, because I think that they'll talk around the edges of internet safety and responsibility, but ultimately putting proper safety nets in place will jeopardize their ability to make billions of dollars a year. And I don't think they'll do it.